Hello there, this is Han Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Toddcast. When we talk about political science, one thing we always have to keep in mind is that the historical precedent is helpful, but can quickly go out of date as technology and culture change. The era of big political machines gives way to reform movements. Fundraising shifts from institutions to individual donors. Messaging is constantly moving from one technology, for example, direct mail, to another, Twitter and Facebook. Joining me now is Michael Cohen. No, not that Michael Cohen, which is something he's had to say quite a bit recently. This Michael Cohen is the author of a new book called Modern Political Campaigns, How Professionalism, Technology, and Speed Have Revolutionized Elections. He's also the CEO of the public affairs firm Cohen Research Group. And good news, Michael, is the book's already out of date because of technology, right? I kid.
Yeah, you know, I have to say, I mean, first of all, thanks for having me on the program. And thanks for clarifying who I might be.
how annoying has that become? Or is it kind of funny? Or how do you, is it like an icebreaker? Have you turned it into an asset? I mean, you know, just curious.
Well, I think, first of all, I've had the common name for a long time. I grew up on Long Island. There were two others growing up on Long Island with me. And so, you know, one time we were brought into the principal's office and, you know, one of us had a book that was late. And it wasn't me. And so I've had that experience before. And I feel like this has been sort of the same thing, except now I get tweeted at by Diamond and Silk and other luminaries like Geraldo Rivera, you know, who haven't figured out that I'm not the other guy.
Right.
I use it. I mean, it's fun. I mean, I have a good sense of humor about it. I mean, I think it's, you know, just you have to sort of take Twitter for what it is, for example.
So look, I really am glad, you know, this is the type of stuff. I always say I'm a campaign junkie. When people say, are you a political junkie? I say, I'm a campaign junkie.
Yeah.
It is not just, you know, the numbers, not just election results and all this stuff, but it's how campaigns are conducted. I've always been fascinated. I mean, one of my favorite political campaign books is Tricky Dick and the Pink Lady. And it's one of my favorite parts of it is how, you know, here's Nixon who used a helicopter and it changed the way he could navigate the state of California, you know, and the point, you know, and then it was within 2 years, we were doing television advertising. So we're always changing political campaigns. What was been remarkable, I would argue, over the last 30 years is how little things had changed really until the last 10. Is that fair?
I think so. But I think there's also been sort of an evolution over time where professionalism has really become far more than even when you and I were in college, Chuck. Yeah. You know, we're actually 2 years apart and born on the same day, of all things.
I didn't realize. Wow.
Yeah. But
are you 74 or 70?
Yeah. I thought I was 85 and you're 83. I mean, but basically what happened was
the only reason I ask is the best April 8th anniversary there is April 8th, 1974, the day Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's home run record. So,
That was fantastic. And, you know, are you a April 8th fan of John Madden, Tom DeLay, or Robin Wright?
That's interesting. Well, because of my Mrs. Todd, it's easily the answer is Robin Wright. You need to add Rob Johnson to your April 8th list, my friend.
Yes. There's a whole list of them. It's actually a lot of fun. I guess the way I look at it is that over the past 25 years, since I've come out of college with my PhD over at University of Florida, you know, they didn't have a political campaigning program through the journalism college. Now they do. You know, other campaign programs have sort of propped up over the years. And so now what you find is your typical person who goes and works on a campaign is not somebody who has no experience, but someone who has more background than they used to. And so, you know, they knew how to do more parts of this. They just haven't done it in a campaign. And then for, you know, where we are right now, I'm teaching students over at Hopkins, where you teach also as well. And, you know, I'm trying to help them get ready for the campaigns of the future, including the ones that are going on right now. And it's a moving target, like you said.
Well, it feels like that what's happening with campaigns is no different than what's happening in marketing and every marketing department. In every company, which is, it's all about data and how you use it, right? I mean, this is the explosion, right? Is, you know, I remember it was micro-targeting with George W. Bush, and then Barack Obama sort of took micro-targeting and put it online. And I mean, we're the explosion of data, the amount that we have and the amount that can be manipulated. This is what's revolutionizing campaigns, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, I was just on another program, I guess a couple of weeks ago, and I was making the argument that this all goes back to data. The reason is because we no longer know like whether or not you voted, but we now know so many more things about you, and we know your behaviors as well, which websites you're going on, which social media you're using, things you're buying, things you're watching, things you click off very quickly as opposed to dive into. And so the more we know about voters, the more you can target them individually, not just as sort of smaller groups we can be micro-targeting. I would say that the revolution really in political campaigns right now is trying to get down to the individual level. And you may not be able to do that on every campaign, but on well-funded campaigns, you really do have far better picture of who your voters are and who the persuadables are, which is increasingly narrowing. And those become a higher prized commodity, in this kind of environment. And so from my perspective, it does all go back to data, and it's not just because I'm a data guy. But everything else jumps off of that, including the marketing, including, what information is really useful in a campaign, whether it's, positive, negative, or neutral, where you're going to go ahead and move people on election day, where you're going to raise money, where you're going to spend it. I mean, all those things go back to data. And because of the revolution in data and the mobilization of data, we now have really incredible opportunities that we can, deploy all the basic principles of campaigning to.
One of the things I think I find interesting about what we're seeing, though, with modern campaigns is everything old is new again. Meaning, remember what a waste of time door knocking seemed to be in the 80s and 90s?
Oh, yeah.
Right? And the idea that canvassing and it all seemed to be laborious. Why are you bothering with that? You can talk to more voters in a television ad than you can with a letter, right? Or than you can with a doorknob. And that got flipped on its head, arguably, when would you say? Is it 04 that it really sort of people realized, wait a minute, actually personalizing your touch, the campaigns that personalize the best are the ones that win.
Yeah, I would say it was around 04. And again, it's sort of the leap forward in data. I would also say there was a huge leap forward after 08, after the first iPhone came out, because all of a sudden we now had things in our pockets that can help have people reach us. And so, for example, what we find even in polling is reaching people to invite them to polls through mixed mode. One of the best ways to do it is really to text somebody. You can't get certain populations because they won't answer their email, but they will answer their text. And so it's great for fundraising. It's also great for research. And it's great for a lot of reasons. But like you said, everything that is old is new again is sort of going to my point about the revolution in politics. It used to be you would round up your town, you'd be that person, you would get elected, and you'd serve. And now what we're finding is the revolution is going back towards more individualistic appeals. People, person-to-person campaigning was huge, particularly in 2020, when you couldn't have mass rallies. If you were a Democrat, if you were a Republican, you were running them anyway. But the door knocking and all the kinds of things that came out of sort of the experimental research that Sasha Eisenberg extraordinarily well covered in the Victory Lab, and this book is essentially a companion piece to that, and sort of expands the field of what you would want to know, and also dives deeper into certain things that he didn't. But what he did was he looked at some of the Gerber research that showed that the door knocking, the person-to-person interactions is much more powerful than any kind of thing you will see on your screen as you're flying through your timeline.
What is the, it's interesting you noted the iPhone in 07, right? We did not know what the 08 campaign was going to look like in 2000 on a technological basis.
Right.
So, but I'll tell you one thing that I thought was coming and hasn't happened yet, which is and I'm wondering, is this the biggest new feature that'll take place probably more in 28 than 24? And that is the personalized TV ad, where we already get personalized emails or perceived to be personalized emails, perceived to be personalized texts. How soon are we going to have that kind of concentration, almost made for you ad that pops up on your Hulu or pops up on your YouTube or pops up on your if you're watching Peacock, without buying the ad-free service?
Right. And that's where it's going to go, right? It's not going to go, on your local, NBC channel while we're watching you on Sunday. It's going to go to all of the other platforms that you subscribe to. And they know a lot more about you. So it actually is much more efficient way to reach you. So my guess is that we are probably one or two cycles away, like you're saying. I would imagine we probably master it somewhere around 2026. But there are a lot of great organizations that are really working on that right now, and sort of the over-the-top appeals on trying to figure out, what kinds of ads are going to work for Chuck Todd or this Michael Cohen. I would say that it is a learning process, but you are dead on that is actually where the ball is going, and some of the best analytics firms understand that, and they're partnering up with the smart media shops, and they're figuring out ways to do that. But again, I mean, some of that has to do with budget. But there is definitely the interest in trying to figure that out, because we're getting to the point right now where everyone who is polarized is identifiable.
Yeah.
And then once you figure that out, who's left? And in some districts, they're going to end up being still, even after redistricting, there's still going to be a few of them that you're going to fight over. And then on the larger, scale races statewide and also, national election, you're going to have to go and find those extra voters, right? And so that will be where the models go, the premiums go, and where the data will help us find what I think is probably the next wave of campaigns, which is we find ways to bring those people together from the center out as opposed to from the out in. Like, I feel like we've gotten to the point, Chuck, where we've kind of mastered how to turn people out on both sides. But we haven't figured out how to build it from the middle out so that you can actually govern, in a permanent campaign scenario.
Well, in fact, you're transitioning where I wanted to transition. You, and I appreciate you as a political consultant writing this sentence. The permanent campaign and all we've covered in this book has broken the Republican system and brought us Republican small r here. We're a republic, reminder to those listening. For political campaign professionals, but I'm not sure this is good for us as a country. Look, fragmentation, in the entertainment world, I was just listening to a podcast the other day. It's sort of like, are we ever going to have another Friends? Meaning, is there going to be a show that captures the imagination of 50 million people that have, like Ted Lasso could have been that show, but it's on this like tiny little slice of the streaming pie and Apple, right? And it's a very small
segment. If you don't subscribe, then you don't get it.
And you don't get it. Right. Well, if in politics we have so fragmented our voter outreach, right, and we're able to give me an ad on guns and give you an ad on abortion and give you an ad, sort of hit whatever your voter turnout erogenous zone is, it does make it that much harder to govern. We don't have a shared concern, a shared experience, a shared set of values that we're voting for. And it's sort of like, it feels like that we're not thinking about these ethical challenges as we race to abuse and use the technology.
I agree with you. And that's actually my main concern about all of this. Like after I kind of went into it sort of with as much of an open mind as one can, who's been working in it for 25 years. But I work with students and I work with professionals on both sides of the aisle. And so I'm fairly open and I'm kind of a squish Republican anyway. So I'm probably banned from my own party at this point. But I would say this, that when you're looking at trying to find shared experiences, isn't it crazy that Friends became the shared experience for Gen Z? I mean, they started watching Friends and really enjoying it. Right. I'm finding, and the same thing is going to happen fairly soon with Seinfeld when it heads over to,
I'm not as convinced.
On you know, Netflix. I think, well, maybe among people of a certain persuasion. I think that Friends is obviously the easiest one, right? But it's very hard to find these common things. And so what you really have to rely on, and this is sort of the charge that I kind of throw out to the industry as well as leaders, is that you have to be those people. And I know that it is, counterintuitive in this day and age, but leadership matters more now than actually it did when all you had to do was communicate to everybody. When all you could do was communicate to everybody. Like now, the premium on leadership is just so high. And to me, at some level, you're going to start seeing people bubble up who are going to say, I have to do this because it's right. Or I have to do this because, you know, I have to run another election today.
Is this a social media influencer effect?
I think
these are leaders. Are these going to be the future leaders? The social media influencer crowd? Are they going to figure out that this is a viable strategy, or is it not really a viable strategy?
I don't know that it comes out of social media. I think it's going to have to come out of the professionals in the industry, and I think it's going to have to come out of the leaders who are actually running. So at some level, they're going to have to realize that you've polarized as much as you can. So where do you find the other voters? And so at some level, that is going to bring you back to a place where we can have more shared experiences. I mean, last year, for example, we had a shared experience. It was awful. It was COVID. And instead of actually pulling us together like a war would, it actually pulled us apart because the leadership of one particular party decided that it was in his interest to do that. And so all these institutions that we have, and as well as this political system that we have, rest on good people doing good things. And they're not always going to do that. And we ran that play last year. And so, you know, we have to understand that, well, is that an outlier or is that where the ball is going? And my hope is that there are people who are working at least quietly to make sure that you know, that's not where the ball goes. That we saw what happens when you do that. It's bad. You know, there's real world consequences to when something like that happens. And, you know, we need to pull together.
I'm going to pause there. We'll be right back after a quick break. You've been listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press.
The countdown to the Paris Olympics is on. Hi, everybody. It's Savannah and Hoda.
Yeah, this week, the Today Show brings Paris to our plaza.
And Wednesday, America's best athletes are here live to celebrate 100 days to go.
So join us this week on Today on NBC.
If you ever needed to be persuaded that bad things can happen anywhere, then take a journey with us.
From compelling mysteries to in-depth investigations, our Dateline episodes are available as podcasts.
Follow Dateline NBC now to get new episodes every Tuesday. To listen ad-free, subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or datelinepremium.com.
Great storytelling with a twist from the true crime original.
Let me tackle this from another direction, and maybe, you know, since I use the phrase political science, we can have a little bit of a political science discussion. Is our technology, is the ability we have to talk to voters in such a personalized way, would it be actually more amenable if we were a parliamentary system? You know, it's like, is it impossible to have the two party coalitions that we have, right? Which is, we don't really have two political parties anymore. We have a left of center coalition and a right of center coalition, right? And that's sort of how we're divvied up these days, right? When you have people that have a net negative view of the party, of both parties for different reasons, you know, it seems to me that people don't love belonging to a political party, but they do understand they belong either to the left coalition or the right coalition. But it feels as if our fragmentary campaign concepts here actually work against, I mean, just look at how hard it is to put the Republican coalition together. Yes, there may be a common theme on taxes, but there's not a common theme on the democracy or on health or on Trump, the person, or the rule of law, right? So right. It becomes much harder to keep, and we're all watching to see if Biden can keep his coalition together, right? It's very difficult. He's trying to do it, you know, right now just on spending money. You would think when you're just spending money, you should have to be able to keep people together. Is our two-party system just not built to handle fragmentation in messaging?
Well, actually, I mean, now we're going to get really nerdy. You know, it goes back to Madison, his view on factions, right? And so, you know, the unifying theory of parties is that you pull these factions together in different parties, and then you go out and win elections. The problem is that the factions now are much more powerful than the parties themselves. And so, for example, Chuck, I mean, bringing it back to the modern day, if you look at what campaign spending is in any congressional district, let's say it's a hot district and people are spending millions and millions of dollars, a lot of that money if not most of it, is actually outside money as opposed to inside money. So like you don't even have control over your own campaign. And the party, which used to be able to help you win elections because they were able to raise money and pull you towards a shared group of ideals, doesn't have the footprint that it has anymore as these outside groups do. So you're being pulled by different parts of the coalition. And so it's super hard then for someone who, let's say, got a big dump of money from one group, go into a caucus with Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer or anyone, and then listen to those people when they realize, well, I got my seat because I listened to this group. So it's very difficult. So the leaders who are good at this, you know, understand where they are and are trying to bring them into the fold. It's one of the reasons why you see, like, you know, Nancy Pelosi working her brains out with different parts of her coalition, trying to keep them together. And frankly, how you've seen, McConnell move away from where he was, right after January 6th, to recognizing that, you know, there's going to be a place for, you know, former President Trump in the coalition because he needs it, because that's going to actually move people in certain primaries. And those people are going to get elected, and then he has to deal with them when they show up. So it is much more difficult now, but not impossible. And frankly, it just really, again, it falls back to who are leading the parties, you know, in Congress and, you know, in various places around the country. It places a higher premium on excellent, you know, and really smart leadership. It just makes it harder.
All right, let me ask a question this way. We've had this huge debate over HR1, and HR1, it's a messy bill. Look, I don't want to get into the substance of HR1. But Michael Cohen, the political consultant, what is legal? Yeah. What is legal that shouldn't be in political campaigns?
What is legal that shouldn't be?
Yeah.
Okay. The biggest problem that I have is that money can be hidden in politics.
Right.
I hate the idea that people can throw money, you know, millions and millions of dollars into groups, and it goes into a black hole. Like, to me, that's the problem. Like, I want to know who's spending money trying to influence me. And so, you know, you see a group and, you know, like the Lincoln Project or other big groups, and you just don't know where the money's coming from. So the transparency is kind of a big problem to me, because like at my core, I'm a J school guy. And so, you know, transparency to me is really the thing. And be the one thing that it would change.
I would joke that Democrats ought to introduce Mitch McConnell's campaign finance bill from 2000. If you could get Mitch McConnell, because in 2000 he was for instant disclosure, and now he's not. But like, there was a time where instant disclosure was something that Mitch McConnell fought for, but it was his counter to McCain-Feingold at the time, and right. He knew, you know, whether he really meant it or not. But I've always thought, well, somebody just introduced the bill he wanted in 2000, because it would be an improvement on money.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's the core problem in politics, is that you always feel like you don't know who's trying to influence you, that there's some shadowy group that is trying to move you in one way or another, and you don't know who they are or what their particular interests are. So if you know that, I feel like that really helps. As far as how much money is in campaigns, I'm not the kind of person who's going to say, well, and again, I'm a consultant, but I'm not the kind of person who's going to say, well, there's too much money in campaigns. In some races, I would say there's actually not enough, because if they had more money, they could actually focus on the voters that I'm actually most concerned about, which is somewhere in the middle.
That's the irony. It is, the voters that are deciding these elections are the hardest to reach and the most expensive to reach.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah. And so like, if you don't have a fully funded campaign, you can't reach them, which means that you end up just become a more extreme candidate. Yeah.
Right. You end up just doing the easy stuff. Well, we don't have the money to do that correctly, so we'll just beat the crap out of the right and just try to make this a base election. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, and hope our people show up, right? And we'll do everything we can, but we can't afford people that I'd want to talk to. And that's sad. Like, so I don't know that so I don't think money's the problem. I think transparency is the problem. And I also think that there has to be some kind of common, better political science education. I really think that like political science education has really let down our leadership. Like, you go through political science and you're learning about, you know, Locke and Rousseau and all the basic principles.
Oh, my goodness. I think political science curriculum in this country is awful. Does not actually teach you about American politics and how it works.
Right, right. And actually, Chuck, that's why I wrote this book. You know, I wanted people to understand how elections actually really work. You know, not from a partisan perspective or an ivory tower. You know, it's the book I wanted to read. And, you know, it came out of my experience, you know, in the classroom, out of the classroom, writing, you know, and teaching. And I think that people, you know, when they look at it, I hope they walk away and feel like, you know what, this is the thing that actually breaks it down for me so I can understand it. It's not talking over my head. It's not talking to me from one side or the other. It's trying to tell me like how this actually works. And to me, like, that's where political science education needs to go if it wants to be relevant moving forward. Because if one of the best classes I ever took was with Bill Hamilton as a graduate student. So I was a PhD student at this time. So I had already gone through political science classes and, you know, got my A's or B's or whatever.
Bill Hamilton, a long time. He's a late pollster. Basically the first great pollster of the state of Florida. And some would argue nobody else has figured out how to poll Florida since Bill.
No, I think Bill was the OG, literally the OG. And he also taught at the University of Florida as an adjunct. And so he's been sort of a model for my career. And he was a great guy. And so he would put us in scenarios where, you know, you had a candidate and they had another candidate. You had to run against each other. You had to do different things. It was the only class in all my time, and I have a PhD in political science, that really took me out of concepts and put me into reality. And so it's really sad that, like, through all that time, I only had one real class that taught me anything about, you know, real politics. And to me, like, that's a shame. So we need to move from just those kinds of programs to, you know, the programs like, you know, your alma mater at GW. They have a great program, the graduate school.
No, I mean, it started literally, I think the year I left GW, they were just starting this. My old mentor, Doug Bailey, was a big help on that. And at first it wasn't the best, but they've really developed a great curriculum. I really think they have.
Yeah, it did. You know, and I've worked with Laura Brown. I was there as the interim director for the political management program for a couple of years. And, you know, what's good about it is that it is trying to move it forward, right? They're not even all the way there where I would take them, you know, to like campaign trainings and things like that that you would get from parties or you get from other groups. Right. But to me, like, the more technical and granular we get at this stuff, I actually think it's better for democracy, because then we know how these machines work, and then we can actually do a better job. And then the other thing too is there's a course that frankly should be absolutely taught everywhere for political science. It's ethics and politics. And so like that class is taught by former Congressman Bob Carr over at GW. And to me, like, that is the course where you have to look back and say, okay, take a step back here. Why are you doing this? You know, why did you get into this in the first place? And to me, you know, it's a daily reminder of why I got into it. I cared about the country, you know, and I didn't want to just vote every 2 years or every 4 years. You know, I wanted to be involved in it. And I think a lot of people go into that, and then as they become professionals, the metric for being a good professional is wins, right? And right. So, you know, if you have clients, they want to win. And so it's winning. And it's, you know, one of the best consultants that I saw on the Republican side said to me one time, you know, my motto is just win. And I looked at her and I'm like, okay. You know, and I drove home and I was thinking about all the way home. And I'm like, God, you know, like, that's part of the problem. Like, you can't just win. Like, you have to, how you play the game is just as important as to whether or not you win or lose in a democracy. Because you can lose the democracy. You can poison the game. And so you need to look at all of this together, you know, the ethics, obviously the background, you know, the history and all that, and then also the nuts and bolts to actually have a good education to do this for a living. And I think that we've let down some of the people who have gone through the system in different schools. And now we're trying to do some remediation on the other side, and it's very hard.
Look, I'm so glad you brought up the ethics. I got to wrap this up, but I'll tell a quick story. Like I said, my mentor, Doug Bailey, he was a very successful Republican consultant in the 70s. He sort of owned the state of Ohio. Dave Thomas, founder of Wendy's, decides he wants to run for governor. And Doug, you know, he wants to hire Doug, and he brings in all the Jim Rhodes people. And this goes way back. And I'm just
saying
things of that. And Doug just said, well, why do you want to be governor? And Dave couldn't answer the question. And it said to me a lot about who Dave Thomas is. Within a day or two, he goes, I'm not going to run. I don't know why I want to run. He realized he was just running because everybody said, well, why don't you run for governor? You're a successful businessman. But a less ethical consultant would have just said, great, let's figure out why you want to run. And we just need more ethical political consultants left and right.
Yeah. And I actually, in the book, really land that point. That's a Simon Sinek line. You know, you got to know the why. And that's one of the things I teach in all my classes is like, if you've got a client who doesn't know why they're running, you need to rethink about taking that client because they need to have something and it has to go to the core of who they are and what they want to do. Otherwise, you end up in a situation like Hillary Clinton did where Brooklyn was trying to figure out why she was running. And she said to them, well, that's why I hired you. That's the wrong answer.
I have a pollster friend. I don't want to like keep name dropping. Doug is someone I'm very close to, so I feel like I'm.
No problem.
But I had another pollster. He refused a client because the client said, "Well, it's your job to tell me what to be for." And he goes, "No, that's not the way I do this."
Good.
But I don't know how many others would have.
And that's the problem, right? I mean, that's the right answer, but I assume that your friend is, you know, super successful in what they're doing.
Well, he was a successful pollster, and he's now semi-retired. And
okay.
And part of me thinks it's because, you know, he wouldn't take just any schmengi.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Anyway, Michael, congrats on the book. I agree. When I was in college, I was desperate for books like this. I ended up reading What It Takes. I learned more from that I did from some of these political science classes. And I love the history of these in these political science classes, but it didn't teach you about modern politics. Michael, congrats on the book, my friend.
Thank you so much, Chuck. I appreciate it.
The only problem you are is a gator. But other than that, you
know. That's okay. That's okay. You being from Miami, I guess hurricanes?
Of course. Yeah. That's the school with more national titles in football. That's how you should just refer to them. Just remember that. No other school in the state of Florida has more. But whatever.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, we're like number five right now. Like, we're awesome.
Okay.
I mean, it's better than when I was there, Chuck. I mean, you know, everyone's smarter than we were when they were going to school.
I know. Who could that? Can't even get in. All right, Michael. Okay. Thank you, buddy. You've been listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Matt Rivera and Megan Liebowitz. John Reese is our executive producer, and our theme music composed by Spoke Media. You can catch Meet the Press daily on MSNBC every day at 1. Meet the Press reports is on demand on Peacock, and the big show is available every Sunday morning on any platform you want. Thanks for listening, and until we upload again.